But so anyway, again, we're on kind of our journey here, and again, we have a few minutes for people coming. I do appreciate y'all coming in for this, these extra classes, and coming in, like I say. But kind of what this is sort of, an, especially if you really wanted to know, okay, where is this stuff at? The books that I had intended, and I did, in at least the table, give you the location, so it gives you a feel for where these objects are actually located. And some of this we're going to come back around and talk about in some different classes, like the Dead Sea Scrolls are going to be a big component of our discussion on the archaeology of the Bible text. So that's kind of a class, that's one of our extra classes that we've got. So we'll spend some more time. So this will be kind of just a kind of a flyover of them. But again, I think repetition is good, and kind of coming at it from some different angles. So, you know, some of these things we'll kind of go through, and again, there's some things that involve crucifixion, burial, things that have been found, and we have a class just talking about how they crucified people and how they buried people in the time of Jesus. So we have that. So if you feel like I've gone too fast or that you want more, some of this you're going to get more of, and we're going to kind of come back around on. So hopefully, I was, this morning we just flew through this, so we'll just kind of remind that hopefully if in this class we improve your knowledge of Bible locations, Bible places, Bible people, and timelines. That has been beneficial. And one of the reasons, right, that we got to try to keep a track on timelines is we're going all through the Bible from the Genesis all the way to Revelation, and that covers a lot of time. So to kind of keep your mind where we are, and I could have, unfortunately, I figured I didn't do as good today on that as far as this particular lesson, but that's one thing we'll try to do. Locations also, as we go through these things, that you come to realize these are real people, real places, real times. And I've enjoyed some of our outside conversations from people in the class and all. It seems like they really, several of you, are really kind of a little bit excited about this, or it's perked up an interest. And you had the conversation this morning, I was really excited that someone I really hadn't thought would have gotten really pumped up on this was really pumped up on this. So, and again, it's real places, real people, real events. And that we just strengthen our faith, because they're just, the critics are there barking, barking, barking. And you really say, okay, sometimes you kind of question, do we have good evidence? And really, when you look at all of this, all these confirmations, we don't use that word proof, these things we talk about, big time confirmation, capital letter confirmation of the things that we're reading in the Bible. So here we are on our kind of find here. Next Sunday afternoon, we'll do the archaeology of Jerusalem. This is where I get to go wild, lots of pictures. And then we will finish our last time together. We will look at this archaeology of the text. So this is kind of our afternoon activities. And again, I appreciate y'all coming and hearing this. Okay, so if this kind of really perks your interest, the things that we're talking about, these top tens, or, well, it's kind of top tens or more, that if you're really kind of interested in that, these two books really are good reference sources, and I will tell you, a lot of the material for this class, this is where it came from, or this is kind of where I was, you know, was getting this. The other thing that we kind of did is that every year they'll say, what are the top 10 biblical archaeology finds in their sites? What are the top 10 finds? Some said there's no way you can do top 10. They'll do 28, 50, 100. But what I did was went to several different lists and kind of tried to rank there on the list and all. So that's kind of where that came from. So, but again, this kind of gives you a feel and at least gives you a clue as to how I ordered them the way that I did. Now, we ended up, of course, with much more than 10 kind of artifacts listed in the class lesson. Realizing, again, I'm in nowhere of the capabilities of Barry, I have limited myself basically to the top five. And I really hurt because I would look at number six or further ones down on the list, and we could have spent more time. But in the Old Testament finds, really everybody, well, a lot had the Dead Sea Scrolls, but I put the Dead Sea Scrolls actually in the New Testament or between the Testament. So they ended up on the other list. But high on everybody's list is this Tildan. Stella, okay, found 1993, so pretty recent compared to some stuff 1868, 1838, whatever. But where it really comes is showing, confirming there's a house of David. Now, to you, you say, what do you mean? You question whether there's a house of David? Well, in the mid-80s, kind of coming out of Denmark, but Israel Feinstein really jumping in with this crowd, are these Bible minimalists who basically say nothing is correct in the Bible. Zero reliability. Okay? And so they really hammered at David because 93, I mean, for some of us, that doesn't seem too long ago, right? They really hadn't found documentation saying King David, House of David. You say the guy had a kingdom. Surely he had to exist. Now, you know, some of the stuff we talked about this morning, and then we'll really get into it big time on Wednesday, is saying, yeah, they're real. But it was found, and the reason they probably, again, you know, you say, what in the world does the city of Dan have to do with David? Okay? Do any of us really think of King David hanging around the city of Dan? You know, we talk about him in Judges and some things like that. But here's kind of the wall of Dan, kind of in the times of the divided kingdom. And they had this sort of pavement there. And they were working along in here, and about in this location, they flipped a stone. And it wasn't a stone. It was a repurposed stone. So this was, Estella is this big, a king saying, I did this. Okay? That's what that is. Saying how great I am, how wonderful I am. So there was Estella placed there by one of the Syrian kings, kind of saying, boy, I beat up on Israel and Judah, okay? So, but just, again, you know, you think, okay, pavement, and, oh, the critics, they spent 5 years or so saying the evidence was planted. I'm exaggerating just a little there. But they found, and they found this one first, and then they found this one, dating this, puts it at around 800, but then 850 is what I read several places. So, you know, you can get back and forth. But anyway, King Hazael, one of those kind of, again, names of that kings of these different places, kind of talked about that he killed the king of Israel and killed him and the king of Beit David. My bad Hebrew there, This is the same wording. If you go to Isaiah 7:2 and you're a Hebrew person, it's the same phraseology, okay, of Isaiah. And so that house of David that, you know, we read about, like in Isaiah, you know, 250 years. Now, this is where they were supposed to have been invented. In other words, so, you know, it's like the 400s that David was invented, okay, by these returning Jews from captivity. Everybody knows that. Because, again, if I don't believe in miracles, how do I explain the Bible? So they have to have everything done after the event. So, you know, here, 250 years before supposedly David was made up, is this discussion of King David. So now, to us, I don't know that it's as important. Now, to me, I'm more intrigued by this Stella and, you know, kind of, again, this kind of bragging concept, saying I killed both of these. Well, it was like around Jehu, right, that the king of Israel was wounded, went back. But, you know, kind of based on my understanding, this guy's bragging, you know, I sent the king of Israel there where Jehu killed him, and Jehu killed, you know, the king of Judah. But, you know, none of this would have happened if it hadn't been for me. So, therefore, I killed them. So there you also get a feel for how kings like to brag. But here it is. Anybody that can read Hebrew realize it's read this direction.
What direction?
They don't go right to left. They go left to right, Chester. Although the picture wouldn't have even shown you that. I just was reminding people.
They go right to left.
All right. So here is the translation. Again, those who are Hebrew scholars. I slew men, chariots, horsemen of the king of Israel, and I slew the king of the house of David. So that's kind of what the inscription is on that. So, again, this whole minimalist, this pretty much put them out of the loop. This really just, now they have fought, and they're still fighting. They're now fighting over whether the six-gated gates of six-chamber gates is Solomon or later. But again, this just pretty much put them. Because, again, one of the worst things you can say when you're trying to say the Bible is all wrong is to say, I haven't found it yet, to argue from that. Realize most critics argue from, we haven't found evidence. Okay, so now the next one is just very powerful in my mind. This is the silver Ketef Hinnom scrolls at the Israel Museum. All right, so Hinnom, y'all have probably heard of, the Valley of Hinnom, right? Well, this was found in the Valley of Hinnom, and it was found at a tomb. And dates kind of right before, like the days of Josiah and right at the first taking away of the captives, or right in that time period there. And what it is that, you know, we read about that you're to keep, you know, the Lord's word, you know, with you, scribe it on your doors, things like this. So this person who was buried had a silver amulet. And what they did is, it was all rolled up, but they had inscriptions or phrases from the Bible, from Numbers and from Deuteronomy, and they had etched it and micro-etched from the books of Deuteronomy, Numbers. And again, realize those weren't written until the 400s. But here we are sitting in the 600s, with them having been written, sort of against, disproving that. Also, this is the oldest Bible text that we have surviving. Okay? And when we go to the museum, they don't have, of course, the real things. But we're going to go through the gallery, and they have a reproduction. So I want you all to be on the lookout for this. So they unrolled it. oh, here it was found. You see, again, when you're in the first temple, what you have is they would put the heads here in the crevices. They would have these little things. They would put your body. What you would do is, we'll go more into this when we're doing the burial process, but not so much first temple. But basically, you would die. They would put you there. Your bones, you would decay for a year, and then you would be gathered to your fathers and put into this repository. Okay? Your bones. They would collect the bones and put them. So here is the Hinnom Valley. This is where it's found. Now you may ask yourself, what in the world is this doing? It's supposed to be covered, right? You didn't bury people just out in the open. Well, they quarried the stone. So we're fortunate that they stopped quarrying at that point. And what they did is this had been, was piled up, and they dug down. So it wasn't, they know exactly where it was. They have the history. So they're able to date this very well. And so here's the scroll rolled out. The priestly blessing from Numbers. And then also a slight variation of Deuteronomy. But, may the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make, or Jehovah make your face shine upon you and grant you peace. So that writing is there, and this individual was buried with that. And so, we have, again, we know because it was a controlled dig, we're able to confirm that this wasn't written 400 years later, all of this stuff. So, again, the oldest text we have that has survived of the Old Testament, or a portion thereof. The Moabite stone, we kind of, we've mentioned, but we are going to talk about it a good bit when we get to Ahab, which would be next Sunday. But 2 Kings chapter 3 is where this comes from, and it's this big black stone, actually kind of got broke. Anyway, it's a weird story how it actually came to be broken up. But the Moabite or the Misha stone that you remember that the kings of Judah, Edom, Israel went around to take Moab. And they're fighting them, and the king of Moab sacrifices his son. And everyone kind of says, okay, is this really worth it? So it kind of dates around that, or that's the guy we're talking about. But he kind of, again, from that point, is freed from control by Israel, or he had revolted there. So what's interesting is that, is the other thing is, okay, that people had looked at this and said, okay, yeah, maybe this is the house of David. After they had found the Tel Dan still, they then had, yes, we have a monument with this wording. They were then able to go back to the Moabite stone and say, this talks about the house of David. So it gives us yet another reference to that. And so in line 5, it talks about the king of Israel. And then in line 31, it talks about the house of David. And again, some letters broken, missing, but with the Dan still and having, okay, this is how the wording looks when you're putting this up here. They were then able to say, hold, you even got the Moabite guy talking about the house of David. Next, the Hezekiah tunnel. We'll kind of hit this a lot more when we're hitting, talking about the Hezekiah defense class. But it confirms part of the effort of Hezekiah in fortifying the city, and is a major architectural achievement because they did this all underground. They met each other. And it wasn't until the days of the Romans that you see a similar feat accomplished. I mean, Hezekiah was an incredible king. So anyway, there was a kid playing hooky in 1880 in the tunnels, playing in the tunnels, and he notices this inscription. It's now in the Istanbul Museum, but it talks about, and it records what they decide, kind of, how do you remember, how do you make note of this accomplishment of starting at two different ends and coming together, and what they do is they recount that they were, let's see, I was thinking about 3 feet apart, but there were a certain distance, and they could hear the hammering of the other guys, and they knew that they had finally come to meet. And so here you have, from the time of Hezekiah, you have confirmation, because they would argue, well, who did this tunnel? You know, was it Hezekiah? Was it somebody else that built this tunnel? And so, you know, this was part of the defense that he puts up. And, you know, when you look at Hezekiah and Assyria, I mean, the Assyrian guys make the mistake, right, that they kind of are saying, hey, it's us against your supposed God. And so, you know, they say every city has fallen. Every god has failed to protect. And so, you know, Isaiah saying they're not going to enter there. Isaiah 37, the Assyrians are not going to come in. And that's pretty rough when you see this huge Assyrian army. And then also just the march of them coming there and the things at Lachish. So anyway, the tunnel's kind of wiggly and waggly. That's the inscription there. This is part of what the tunnel looks like. It's at different heights and things like that. This kind of gives you the full. You see, if you're under siege, water's critical. Food and water. So the Gihon Spring is here, and it's right on the wall. So, you know, if you're exposed in any way, anything like that, it's crucial that you're able to get the water. So Hezekiah dug this tunnel, had the water where it flowed, and came to the Pool of Siloam. And so that, so now it's inside the city. People can get all the water they need inside. And that's the reason, I mean, Jerusalem's kind of here, is the spring of Gihon that provided water, especially during siege time. So here's another good image, giving you that full of the Pool of Siloam. Also remember, you know, we talked about Warren, Charles Warren doing the survey, and this is his shaft, again, connecting from the upper city down to that spring. And here, this is the varying heights. So apparently, I mean, there's some erosion and stuff. So some of this would have been possibly natural tunneling that they found. But again, they dug through. And again, this is how much of the city is above them at all. So anyway, some if you're really interested in this, there's some interesting kind of discussion on that. So, okay. I mean, yes, sorry.
I was just wondering, can you, like, take a tour?
Yes.
Walk
yes,
there.
You can.
Wow.
One of the things I was upset when I got to go my one time is Farrell didn't take us through there.
Oh.
But we had older folks, and this is a younger folk adventure. Y'all didn't get to go through. We know. I think it's you got to be pretty capable. It takes a certain good bit of time. I think the line
how,
and stuff.
How long is it?
I don't know. I didn't need to go.
Okay. I mean, it looks really long there.
Yeah, it is. But I will say, of one of the things I would have liked to have done that I didn't get to do, but there's a lot I didn't get to do, because 10 days and stuff. So you either go with a younger, more adventurous person, or you stay a couple extra days and go through that. And then also, it depends. I know we were going kind of, it was still a little bit rainy season, because that level will vary. So I don't know that. I never asked Pharaoh why we didn't go, but I know we did. So.
Well, is the water under your feet and you walk through
yes,
the water?
Yes, yeah.
Oh.
There. You're walking. The water flows. Okay? It flows. And that tide can vary. I mean, someplace I've seen it up, some pictures up to the chest. They usually in too much of that. But yeah, no, yeah. Yeah, you're walking in water.
The engineering is marvelous.
Oh, it's incredible. And I do have an arm.
How did they cut through that rock?
Huh?
How did they cut through that rock?
Oh, cutting through, it's limestone. It's pretty easy to cut through.
Oh, okay.
The thing is how do you keep track of where you're at? Again, they start at two different ends, and they meet. Okay? They meet, and you've got, you know, lots of rock above you. Now, one article I read kind of in trying to do it is the guy thought they did tapping and that they could hear the tapping so they would know more or less where they were from above. But that's a guess. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, how did it meet? I mean, all curvy and stuff. It, again, not until the days of the Romans did you see a similar fit. And you read the passage in Kings and Chronicles. Oh, yeah. You know, he built the way where the water, you know, that you have no clue of how major an accomplishment it is in Kings. But, you know, we're able to go to look to see, which kind of, you know, again, that it's one of the Bible does a lot of understatement stuff. So it's like, you know, one of the guys that said he had an iron bed during the Bronze Age. Well, that's a huge thing. But it just says he had an iron bed, a bed made of iron. Because that's not the important thing of the Bible, right? What's the important thing? It's not the material. It's the spiritual.
Messages.
The message. And so, you know, it's incredible what we're able to find and understand of the times. But, again, them giving us an archaeological history or a history of everything that's going on, that's not the purpose of the Bible.
And the fact that you don't have all of that, which is must have been amazing to them as well.
Yes.
It's pretty good evidence of inspiration.
Yes.
Because if the usual people had been writing it, they would have gone into detail about that eternal tunnel.
It's like Josephus goes on and on and on. Because it's not inspiration. It's not talking about, you know, God's plan.
Isn't there also some of Hezekiah's wall?
Yes.
That you can, which is mentioned in the scripture, and you can actually see the wall.
Yes. You can. And that, that picture we will see, and what's even more is not too far from that wall, you see the Babylonian arrows, or the Assyrian. I think that's Babylonian arrows they found. But that's in part of Hezekiah's defense that will show that wall. And it didn't make the top 10 of anybody's list. okay. Far as then the Old Testament, finishing up the Old Testament, and again, everything on that list pretty much is pretty cool or pretty interesting to talk about, and that list doesn't even do justice to the other things. So, I mean, this really, the subject kind of catches your interest. Those two books that I talked about are really good. The evidence of the Bible has the best pictures. The lost treasures have the best information of actually how to find them if you want to see them for real. But the Lachish reliefs in the British Museum. So this was found 1847. So very early on. And again, it's like this is the time when people are saying, well, you know, there's no Hittite Empire. Who are the Assyrians? They don't exist. And the guy starts digging up, and there's Nineveh that he finds. And they do this. But there were the Assyrians, you know, had on their wall a relief. And this wasn't the only one of their great victories, their great battles. So you would go around, you would see people being impaled, people being flayed, you know, all these horrible things with the Assyrians, and all the gruesomeness. And it was there so that people could walk, king, we did this, and then this, and then, you know, when I'm king, this is how you do these sort of things. I mean, you know, it's kind of how it's set up. But it is a recording of what of the siege and taking of Lachish. So Hezekiah was trapped like a bird in a cage, but Lachish fell. And also here, and I remember seeing this when I saw these at the Christian Museum, it's just like, wow. Is here is this relief, and you see the guys are doing the slings, as we talked about today. These are stone baseballs that they're slinging, and these are were dug up at Lachish. So the Syrians are doing the slings of these huge rocks, baseball-sized rocks, and when you go to Lachish, when they dug it up, there are those sling stones that they used. So anyway, they're very much, you know, fire painting, kind of very much magnificent. The Lachish reliefs were in the southwest palace of Nineveh. And so here's the courtyard you would walk in. And you see here, here's kind of this room. So it was the Lachish room that you would go in. And that's how the British Museum, you walk in and you just go around the wall. And there's all of the Lachish siege being laid out. So here's a reconstruction. Here's at southwest. And so it's here is where that Lachish room is that you would kind of go in. So, I mean, this was the king was very proud as an Sennacherib of his victory there. Here is the arrows. Here's a ram. To knock on the gates at Lachish. Here's kind of a drawing of that, because here's the way their shields would be. Again, arrows. Takes a little bit getting used to reading those kind of reliefs, so sometimes the drawings are a little more helpful to our eye. Here, they're taking the treasure away. Here, the captives are being taken away. Here, again, more of the captives being taken away from Lachish. Here, they're bowing before the Assyrian king. And, you know, here's the officials of Israel coming to him and stuff. So, and then again, there's another one of them impaling people, but I didn't include that one. Also, it was number 7 on the list, but we have, you know, Sennacherib, you know, the relief, but also there is this prism, and it's on this prism that he accounts his fight with Hezekiah. And, you know, it's like, I took this city, I took this city, I took this city, and Hezekiah I trapped like a bird in a cage. So a sort of different viewpoint than what Hezekiah had, but the net result's the same, right? Isaiah said he's not going to take this city. And Sennacherib, you know, I didn't take it. I trapped him, but I didn't take it. So again, that confirmation there. And again, you just look, there's little Jerusalem, and then all of everything else was conquered. Dead Sea Scrolls, again, we're going to have spend a good bit of time with them. But they moved, they're our oldest manuscripts there. So some of them date, that's like 125, but actually some they'll push back to around 200 BC or a little bit into at least the mid period. This is, I mean, I think the Isaiah scroll is like 125 BC there. And so again, this is before Jesus, so like all the prophecies. That's the prophetic messianic prophecies is just, there's no way around them. That you have here Isaiah script talking about the Messiah, talking about Isaiah 53. And it's interesting that we have pretty much the whole book of Isaiah. Most of the others are fragments, but Isaiah, we have the whole manuscript. And also, it's mostly identical to the messianic text. So again, we'll spend some more time with that. It took us, because we were like 1000 AD, 900 AD, and it took us back to the time of Jesus and also into between the Testament. So about 200 Bible books, about 400 manuscripts dealing with just Jewish literature, and then 200 manuscripts kind of dealing with the Essene community. They were stored in this pot jars. It was fortunate, I think, it's a bat dung that preserved it, that the bats pooped on it, and that sealed the clay pots. So that's one of the reasons they're preserved as well as they are. So they would have the scrolls. They had this little buckle here so that they could hold them there. So you also get a very good feel for how scrolls were produced in the times of Jesus. And here's a picture of when some of the scrolls were first discovered. So again, very, very fortunate that we found those. And really, again, So here, like the book of Isaiah, being written in the days of the Hasmoneans, John Hacharis, Artabus, the Qumran and digging goes back to at least the 150 to 160, and it was part of, when we're talking about Daniel and between the Testament, that the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Essenes, all of this kind of came from a reaction of how do you deal with Antiochus Epiphanes, and then the Maccabeans coming on to the scene. So different people responded, or this sort of all of these little sects came out of that pressure of Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay, again, we will have a class where we'll spend more time on this, but we have some pretty good descriptions of crucifixion, of how the Romans went about doing crucifixion, but we didn't really have physical evidence of crucifixion until this bone was found in an ossuary. Kind of. If you don't know what an ossuary is, in a slide or two, we'll hit that. But what had happened was the nail hit a knot in the wood and it curled, and so they couldn't get the nail out of the ankle, and so they just took the nail with it, and as a result, so that's kind of all we have left. That's more a full image and of the foot and that nail going through the heel there. And so a couple of different ways it could have been done, but basically this is saying the feet are against the post and then they nailed that in. And then on him, there wasn't any indications of nails in the arm or anything like that, that apparently a rope was used. So this is, until this was discovered, we had no skeletal evidence of a crucifixion. And it pretty quickly shows us how grim it was. The other thing is that our critics, man, those critics, they argued that Jesus would not have been buried in a tomb. If he was crucified, he would have been thrown in a very common grave. That the Romans didn't allow that. Well, that whole argument kind of goes out the window, because here you have this fellow that the family was able to go to the Jewish authorities, able to get the body, and they were able to put it in the family tomb. Again, it decays, and they put it into this ossuary, which was a stone box where you put bones. So in the first temple, in the days of the kings, you would be gathered up, you would be gathered up to your father, your bones would be put into this little sort of pit with all the bones of your ancestors. Well, there was so much stonework going on in the time of Jesus, because they were working on Herod's temple, that they had these little stone boxes. And so rather than being gathered up, deposited, you would be put in, your bones would be put in there, although they would put quite a few family members in there and all. So, actually, yeah, we may reach him. Okay, next on the list there, and again, we'll hit this more, you'll get another flavor of this when we talk about crucifixion and burial, is in the Ryland Museum, the Ryland Papyrus, is the oldest New Testament text that we have. And this dates to like the 120s AD. Some try to put a little bit later, but about the 120. And so John's Gospel we put in the 90s. So this is like 30 years after the original autographs were done, the original documents. And this is setting down in Egypt. Okay, and they find this. So again, showing John's Gospel is well distributed. This is actually, it sets in Manchester, England. It's always interesting how these things end up at. But anyway, 125, 160, although I think most people will put it at 125. But, you know, Gospel of John 18. And as we'll talk about when we kind of do the archaeology of the Bible text, what's really wild is that they'll look and say, okay, you know, here's this fragment from the Gospel of John. They're able to calculate from that, you know, from both sides, how big the actual manuscript was and all. So we'll spend some time on that. Yes?
The reason why they are symmetrical like that?
Okay, well,
this is the sides of the back. Same.
Yes, this is the same. This is the front and the back. Thank you. I was working on the next slide. So. Good question, though. But that's front and the back.
Okay.
So this is all we have, but this is what the back looks like. In both sides.
In the museum, I actually got to see this. In the museum, they have it like in a glass case, like where you can walk around
right.
And look at it, like both sides.
And so, like, even up in that Manchester area, kids studying Church of England and to be members of the Church in England, they will take them to that museum and show that to them. Okay, the Pilot Stone at the Israel Museum. And this is in Caesarea. And so there again, Pilate says, hey, I gave money for these things to be done, was found. And at this time, again, no corroboration of physical evidence of Pilate. But really where it gets into, and really most of the New Testament manuscripts, when we find these monuments, is confirmation that Luke got it right. That critics really go after Luke and what the name that he uses for the Roman official every time. When they finally find some physical evidence, Luke had it right. Okay? So, great historian, Luke. So here's more what the whole document or stone looked like. Kind of was, again, what was his title? Was it prefect or procurator? The other thing that's kind of interesting is you see this little, where they found it was, it was a stadium seat. It had been turned over so that the writing was preserved. But before it was turned over, it was used as a well cover. So, you know, rocks, you know, someone went to the effort, so they'll do it. Also, I don't know how many of you keep up with the news, but they found this bronze ring in the last year that mentions Pilate. Now, it probably wasn't his because he would have had a finer ring, but was very likely an official. And then here we go to the ossuary. This is Caiaphas. And you look at the stonework. Hey, first of all, most of the ossuaries, the stone boxes, don't have that level of carving. The other thing is realize this is the high priest, right? So the guys who were doing the carving and the stonework at the temple did this work. So you just want to get a feel for some of the beauty of the work, stonework, that would have been at the temple. Look at Caiaphas's coffin there. And then there kind of is the wording and stuff that's said there. Now, it was found, it was kind of the family tomb that was found. And so this is how all the kind of boxes, these are your ossuaries, how they're tossed about, looters and stuff. And then his is back there in a cubby hole. But anyway, contained the bones of six people, two babies, a young child, teenage boy, adult woman, and a 60-year-old man. Now, we don't know if those are the bones of Caiaphas, but that's about the right age. Okay? So, I mean, they were reburied, but, you know, potentially we, you know, there were folks. And again, you know, he was the bad guy, but, you know, you think of the burial of Jesus and the impact of his raising, and then here are the bones of the man that had him put to death. So, again, just very powerful there. All right. Just because I had pulled this one already, and as I was preparing this, realizing I wasn't going to get beyond the first five. But anyway, this is the Erastus inscription at Corinth. And he is mentioned as being in by Paul. And so now there could have been other Erastus, but kind of the way Paul writes about him, there's a fairly good chance that this was the Erastus that we read about in Paul's letters. And this would have been bronze. It would have been bronze letters in this. But here, you know, Erastus, in return for his idolship, laid the pavement at his own expense. And that's what you would do kind of to get a government job. You would do some kind of public work to kind of say, hey, you really should have me in this particular job and whatever. So this kind of, and again, it's pretty good sized stones. This isn't little, is it? You can look at Pharaoh's hand, and that's the height of that's about his hand, isn't it? And then, like I say, you'd have those bronze letters. And again, the title, again, Luke kind of matches in there. So, hey, I made it. We made it through. Yes, so
you got time for just a little brief.
Yes.
I was in the British Museum, which is incredibly large. And complex.
Oh, yes.
And I asked this big guard, could you tell me where the Lakish Room is? Well, he looked all puzzled. And he said, pardon? I said, the Lakish Room. And he looked even more puzzled. But the third time I asked, he said, well, you go down this aisle and you turn to the right and you'll find it. And so I went down that aisle, turned to the right, and there it was, the ladies' room.
Oh!
Yes,
probably.